And turn in your Bibles, if you will, over to Psalm 90. Psalm 90, and if you have a marker, you may want to place it there. That's where we'll be spending a good deal of our time this evening. Several months ago, my younger sister announced that she was having a baby. That is the first baby that will be in the family in about 11 years. So you can imagine the excitement that has kind of rekindled. We have enjoyed the updates from the doctor's visits and the joking about what the baby is going to be named and all that kind of stuff that comes with a newborn's expectancy. But one thing that I have remembered as that baby has been announced and its arrival date is imminent is that any time a baby is born into the world, that is a joyous occasion. And it's also an occasion for us to remember that in a sense, the hourglass is turned upside down. When a baby comes into this world, it's a reminder to us that life is very limited and that life is very finite. In fact, if we look here in chapter 90 of the book of Psalms to verse 12, here Moses says, "So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom." We oftentimes think of Moses in terms of the man at the burning bush, the man who led Israel, the man who brought the plagues on Egypt for the Lord. Rarely do we remember him, though, as a psalmist. But yet here in Psalm 90, we have some of his writings recorded for us. And in that, we find the reminder that our days are limited and that we are to make the most of those days. Because one day there will be a reckoning that will come. And as we discuss this morning, the idea of making the most of the day, of doing the day's work, that one day we will give an accounting for all of those days, all of those gifts that God has given to us. And so as Moses reminded his people and reminds us today, we need to take those days into account. We need to number those days. This evening, I want us to talk about that. I want us to talk about the idea of what we can do to make the most of those days as we think about Psalm 90. As we consider this psalm, one of the things that Moses is going to tell us very clearly is you must understand who the Lord is. You must understand, and to put it in a little bit modern terms, that there is a God and that I am not Him. And so as the psalmist starts out here, Moses starts out, he reminds us about God's eternal nature. Let's look at the first four verses of the psalm. Here Moses writes, "Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever You had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, You are God. You return man to dust and say, 'Return, O children of man.' For 1,000 years in Your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or a watch in the nights." As we consider this point, Moses is reminding us here of the timeless nature of God. He says that for God, 1,000 years is to us like yesterday. That to God, 1,000 years is like about 4 hours. And so in making that point, he says, "I want to remind you of the timeless nature of the One whose goodness is eternal." We remember as well that Peter draws very heavily on this same idea when he told the people a long time after this psalm was written, "Do not overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years as one day." Why does Moses tell us that about God? Why does he remind us that with the Lord? Well, I believe he's setting it up to make another point for us to understand. While he says God is timeless and God is eternal, he also reminds us here that man is very limited. We understand that man has an immortal soul. We understand that when man is born, he will continue to exist forever. However, in this case, Moses is not drawing on that idea, but rather he's drawing on the idea of man's humanity, of his limited time on this earth. If you look in verses 5 and 6, he says, "You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers." He says, I want you to understand this, that while God is timeless and that for God 1,000 years is as a day, for you it is not, mankind. For you, your days are limited here on this earth. And Moses has some people backing him up on that point. We understand that there are some very great men who have testified of this very fact. I think about the man Jacob as he's gone down into Egypt. And Joseph has arranged the meeting with Pharaoh. And here is Jacob standing in front of the leader of the world superpower. And Pharaoh says, "How old are you?" And here's Jacob's response. "The days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning." You and I would think that if we lived to be 130, that would be great, right? That we could see all of these changes and we would be around and as we do, we cling tenaciously to life. We would think that there had been some achievement. As Jacob looks back over his days, he says, "I've lived 130 years, but really it's been a very short life." I think about the man Job as well. As Job was suffering, not knowing why he was suffering, not understanding the test that was being brought on him, he said, "My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to their end without hope." He draws on the imagery of a lady there with her shuttle, and she's putting all of these strings together and running it back and forth, and a good skilled woman could do this very quickly. And he says, just as she's running those things back, that's the way my days are ticking off. And we come to the New Testament and we see the man James put this in very succinct language when he says, "Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes away." Like the steam coming out of a teapot or the morning fog, James says, your life is going to evaporate. Those days that you think are in abundance will soon be over. And so as we think about the words of these men, and as we think about our psalmist Moses, the point that he's making to us, he says, your days are numbered, your years are finite, your life will come to an end. Now Moses isn't trying to discourage us here. He's not trying to draw this big negative to remind us that in a sense we none of us are going to make it out of this life alive. What he's saying is, think seriously about the days you have been given. Think seriously about how you're going to live each of these days that God has provided to you as a gift. And as he makes that point, he then tells us things that will destroy those days. And he warns that we must be very careful about rebelling against the Lord. These next verses are going to tell us that rebellion against God is a waste of time. That when we seek to rebel against the one who has given us these days, that we are wasting, that we are squandering what's been given to us. We think about the statement that he makes back in verse 3 of chapter 90. He says, "You return man to dust and say, 'Return, O children of man.'" I believe it's here that Moses is going to draw on two reminders from the past at his day. Things that the people of his day could have looked back on and understood. Because as we read verse 3, certainly we're drawn back to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 19. After man and woman have sinned, God says, "By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. As Moses seeks to make the point, he says, rebellion against God is a waste of your days. Can you imagine how quickly that would come to the minds of Adam and Eve? Every time Adam, who was now kicked out of the garden, bent down to try to grow his crop, and as he was weeding and he pulled up a briar that ripped his skin open, you think there was a reminder there that rebellion has its consequences? As he had that back-breaking labor now to eke out a living from the earth, he was reminded of the waste that he had made. As the pain of childbirth was multiplied for Eve, was that not a reminder that when you rebel against God, you are not using the day to His glory? Moses reminds them of that fact, and he reminds us of that fact as well. He continues on, and he says in another illustration that those who experience the flood learn. Look at verse 5. He says, you sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. As we consider those people who wasted their days in rebellion against God, we can actually look to a New Testament passage to remind us of what they lost. Matthew chapter 24, the Lord Himself is speaking, telling people to be ready for the return. He says, for as in the days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and given in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Can you imagine those people who for 100 years had made a mockery of Noah? Here was Noah constructing this ark, preaching to them about the coming flood, telling them to make the most of their days, to turn back to the Lord, to put rebellion away from them. And they had squandered those days. And they had rejected Noah. And in the process, they had rejected the Lord. And the rain started and kept coming and kept coming. And soon those words came to their mind that Noah had preached to them to repent and to change. And can you imagine in that very short and newfound awareness, the realization that rebellion has its consequences. And when the waters consume their last breath, they remember that when you rebel against God, there is a penalty that's paid for that. And as Moses comes to his own time, there was the understanding that Israel had to learn and had to understand the cost of rebellion. Moses stood as a witness to that. And as we look down to verses 7 through 9, we can kind of imagine Moses sitting out there in the wilderness, watching, looking, thinking back. I don't know when this was written. I would imagine near the end of that 40 years. And as he is looking back at that time, he says, beginning in verse 7, "For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh." Moses had witnessed the cost of rebellion. Moses had watched as a people who were given such promise and such hope and such blessings as to be counted the people of God, to have the promise of being the treasure of God, a kingdom of priests, now quietly died away with a sigh. These people understood too late the consequences of rebellion. You remember over in Numbers chapter 14, Moses has announced to them the cost, and he said, God is going to make you wander in the wilderness, and those fighting men who wouldn't go into the land, their carcasses are going to be spread here in the wilderness. And the people suddenly have a revival, don't they? And they say, we're sinful and we were wrong. We're going to go take the land. And Moses says, don't do it. God is not with you. And they go anyway. And they're beaten back, run off by those Canaanites who could have fallen even without a fight if that's what God had desired. Rebellion had its consequences for Israel. It had it for the people of Noah's day. It had it for Adam and Eve. And what we must understand is those who reject Christ will face the same fate as these examples. We think about what the apostle says in 2 Thessalonians 1 and verse 9. They will suffer the punishment of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His might. God is saying through Paul that if we reject Christ, we are rebelling just as those who Moses has described. Now, as we look at all of this, Moses is making a point to us. And God is using this psalm for people of all generations thereafter to understand that when you go against God, it is a waste of time in two different ways. You'll not win. And secondly, you're squandering the gift that He's given. And so with all of that in mind, Moses then says there's a call to action. Moses is going to tell us we can be better than this. He tells us that through the grace of God, we can attain higher than these people who rebelled against the Lord. And one of the points that he's going to say is that you need to make a worthy investment in your life. We know, even in our number this evening, there are people who give us advice about how to invest. That if we have a retirement or we have a college fund or whatever it might be, there are those who will say, this is a smart move for you. This is something that will be a good investment. We want to find the people who know what they're talking about, don't we? If we went to a broker and he said, well, you know, if you invest in 8-track tape companies and buggy whip companies, hey, you're going to make a fortune. We'd say, we need to find somebody else. We need to find someone who knows. Isn't it foolish to pour money into business ventures that are destined for failure? And isn't it just as foolish to pour our energies into activities that we know are destined for failure? And so Moses says to us, you need to exercise wisdom in that investment. Let's look back to the passage we started out with this evening. As he tells us to number our days, focus on the second part of verse 12. Teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. How does that broker know how to tell us to invest? He's studied. He's watched the market. He's seen what works. How do we get the heart of wisdom? We study the Word as we talked about this morning. We look at the bad examples of Adam and Eve and the people of the flood and the children of Israel. And we see what doesn't work and we contrast that with good, faithful men and women. And we invest our days wisely. Because the wise one understands that life is going to end at an uncertain time, an unknown time, and every day is put to use as though it were our last. So let's take this to the practical now. How do we invest our lives? How do we make it so that when we draw our final breath and our days are numbered, that we can look back and say, I exercised wisdom, I invested wisely. Let me start out with something just really simple. It's time to get busy. It's time to get busy with this. You know, on your birthdays, as you get older, someone always has the very heartwarming admonition, you know, none of us are getting any younger. You know, somebody's always got to tell us that. It's good advice. It's good to hear. Because we're not getting any younger. Every day that goes by is a day that we don't have any longer. And it's with that in mind that the Apostle Paul says to the Ephesians this in chapter 5, beginning in verse 14. For anything that becomes visible is light, therefore it says, awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of this time, because the days are evil. You see, to be effective, it requires that we commit and that we plan and that we carry out. I imagine this evening, I'm talking to some people who probably have next year's vacation already lined up. You already know, first of all, when you're going, and you know where you're going, and you know what you're going to do when you get there, if the Lord wills to give you that time. I'm with you. I like to do the same thing. If I'm going to go on a trip, I want to squeeze everything out of it I possibly can. I don't want to waste the time. Well, let me ask you. If we can do that with vacations, how much more should we be doing that with the days that God has given to us? Should we not have that same determination, that same commitment and planning that as we looked at this morning described in 1 Timothy chapter 4 of exercising godliness, of getting things together? Should that not describe us? You ever noticed how many action words there are in the Bible? As our lives as Christians are described, we're told about our fight and our work and our walk. Why? Because God says that He wants a group of people who are busy in His service, who are not wasting time, who are not sitting around twiddling thumbs, who are not wasting it on useless endeavors. He wants people who are working daily. Godliness will not sneak up and overtake us. One morning we're not going to wake up and have a warm glow that suddenly godliness has found us and now we've made it. No. Godliness is a work that we pursue to be like our Maker, and it does not come through laziness. And so if we were sitting with Moses on that rock, as he penned the words of Psalm 90, I believe he would say to us, get busy. Don't squander. Don't end your life with a sigh. Spiritually speaking, go out with a bang. As well, the call to action says, don't be a coward. Don't be a coward. It's interesting to me when we look over to Revelation chapter 21. Verses 7 and 8, the one who conquers will have this heritage. I will be his God and he will be my son. There's the Sinai covenant, updated for Christianity, carried on. But now listen to the other side. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. We understood that someone murdered. Oh, we would be up in arms, wouldn't we? We would understand the horribleness of that. If there was someone who was a sorcerer, as we talked about in our Bible class this morning, leading people after idolatry, we would be up in arms about that. Liars, we have no patience with, do we? Sexually immoral, we understand how that tears up the family. But have you ever noticed what begins the list here in Revelation? You ever caught that? That the first in the list, as John writes this, are cowards? That he ranks cowardice with murder and sexual immorality and sorcery and lying? I don't know about you, but I believe there's a point that's being made there, isn't there? That the person who will not experience the second death is the person who is going to, first of all, stand up for what's true. We think about the time of the writing of Revelation. We think about the suffering that people were put through for their faith. How that those Roman emperors, depending on how bad they were, you could have someone like Nero, who in very dastardly ways was finding ways to kill those of the faith. And John is saying, if you don't stand up for what you believe in, if you don't stand up saying, I'm willing to die for my faith, you're listed with these others. But I don't believe that that's where the lesson stops. I understand that God does want us standing up and He wants no one denying faith out of fear. But I believe equally, He doesn't want anybody to be a coward in accepting the opportunities that He's given. When we pray, Lord, provide me opportunities to be a faithful servant in Your kingdom. Lord, help me expand the borders of Your kingdom is a phrase we hear often. God's going to provide that. God is going to open doors. God is going to knock down walls. God is going to give opportunities to us. How will we accept those opportunities? Remember the parable of the talents? You remember the unprofitable servant? Remember what he said? He also, who had received the one talent, came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid. I was a coward. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours. You remember what comes next. You wicked an unfaithful servant. Opportunity had been provided, and opportunity had been squandered, and the master was not pleased. And the point that Christ is making is, when God gives us opportunities, we use them to the fullness of our ability. And that means we ditch the excuses. We stop saying why we can't do the work of God, and we start talking about how we're going to do the work of God. You see, cowardice kills us. I read an illustration of this. It said, just imagine a man's epitaph which reads, died at age 30, buried at age 90. That's what cowardice does. We die spiritually, and all of those days until we draw our last breath are wasted. We remember the old phrase, a coward dies a thousand deaths. How true that is spiritually. Refusing to take the Lord's challenges is a life of cowardice. When He provides the opportunity through His strength, through His grace, we can do it. But it's a matter of accepting that. And let me tie this point in very quickly with that one. Don't wait on somebody else. Don't wait on somebody else to get you motivated. We're going to stand individually before the throne. Paul, though, tells us very clearly about our relationship with brethren and ourselves. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, if one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. Now you are the body of Christ. Okay, that's all of us Christians working together. And individually, members of it. You see, the only way the body works is when the individual members work. And that's you and I. That's us carrying out the commands of God. Let me stop for a minute for a little bit of back patting. There are a lot of folks right here who understand that point. I am so impressed with several things that are going on here. I tell you, everything I hear about this group of young ladies, I think by the self-titled salt shakers is what they call themselves, I understand that there were women who said, we have a responsibility. we understand that God has required older women to teach the younger women, and they're doing it. Young ladies, take advantage of it. I am impressed with men who have given of their time to teach young men how to better themselves in the service of God on a more public basis. I'll try not to embarrass my son, but I'm just going to say he and I both understand he's doing something he never thought he would do. And I'm going to tell you something. It wasn't because of me, because he would be in bad shape if I were the one who was teaching him. But somebody took the time. There are people who got together and said there are people in this community who need the gospel. And we as a group are going to work together to reach out. Did you know every Wednesday night a group is meeting? And they're talking about people who need the gospel. And there are individuals here who have lists out of the phone book who are taking and they're dialing those numbers and they're saying, would you like to take a Bible study course? Those are people who are not waiting on somebody else. Those are people who are saying, I understand that as an individual part of the body, I have an individual role that makes the body function. Therefore, I would encourage all of us, we don't ride somebody's coattails to heaven. Because we belong to an active group does not make us an active member of that group. And I encourage you this evening, if there are talents that you have that are going to waste, don't wait on somebody to give you the invitation to exercise those talents. There are things that as long as they are scriptural and in accordance with the Word of God that you need to be doing because God has given you the opportunity. Question is, will we take them? And as we said this morning, let's don't someday ourselves to death. Let's make sure that we're doing the things that we need to do. And as Moses finishes up the psalm, let's remember that none of this comes without God. Success in numbering our days comes only with Him. Back in Psalm 90, as we pick up in verse 13 and we read down through the end of verse 17, Moses says, "Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants, and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands." As Moses penned those words, he was looking at a group of people who had squandered their opportunities. But he was also looking at a generation that was rising up to take advantage of what the Lord provided. And as Moses calls them to action, he calls us to action. Because as any forgiven sinner must do, we must make that same plea. We must ask for the Lord's help and long for His return to be with Him. But until that return comes, we are working and we're asking Him for the help in doing that work. And in so doing, our faith is centered on God. I'm afraid oftentimes Christians have a bad, bad habit of feeling as spiritually strong as whatever congregation they're a part of. That if the congregation is doing well, I'm doing well. That if the congregation is doing poorly, I'm doing poorly. If the congregation is active, I'll be active. If the congregation's not active, I won't be active. It can't be that way. The work we do together is vitally important, but we stand alone before God. And if a congregation is doing well, we do well because we want to please our Maker. And if the congregation is doing poorly, we do well so that we can seize the opportunities to help the congregation. And if the congregation is inactive, we are active, seeking to bring others along. And if that is our outlook, we're faithful. And we also understand even more of a temptation that our faith is not in ourselves. You see, it's not really what I can do. It's what God can do through me. That's the way it's always been. Starting with Adam right up to the present, it's what God can do through us. If we are willing servants, God is very much ready to let us do His work. But the one thing He said is I'll never force you. But understand that squandered years will have their day of reckoning. We trust in Him is the only way to number our days. The trust that we show in God is the only way that we can make our life worthy. Because you see, the clock is ticking. The hourglass has been turned upside down, and none of us has any idea how many grains of sand are left. In human terms, it may be a lot. It may be almost full. Or it may be dwindling down to the end. But no matter where we are, whether we're 15 or whether we're 95, wherever we are, it's time to get busy making the most of our days. It's taking each day and doing the day's work so that when our life is brought into examination on that last day, God can say, "Welcome home, good and faithful servant." That's where we've got to be. So where are we? As you examine your own life, as you examine the opportunities that God has given you, have they been met with cowardice? I'll confess to you, I have a whole bunch of things I have to look bad on, being ashamed. Realizing that there were precious opportunities that were given that I just simply did not seize, that I didn't take. And the Lord in His graciousness has said, "I've given you another day to do better." Maybe you can say that with me as well. Maybe this evening I'm talking to someone who has squandered a whole lot of days of understanding you need to be a Christian, but you've just not done it. It's time to stop that. It's time to stop wasting the days to take advantage of the gift that God has given you. To understand that you can have salvation and then the opportunity to be an active participant in His family. Maybe you've known that, but you've wasted those days in such a manner that people have seen how you have squandered those days for the ways of the world. If you want us to pray with you this evening, we'll do that. Whatever it takes, whatever you need to do, to make your life right with God, do it so that on that last day, we can hear the words, "Welcome home." This evening, if you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, please do so as we stand and sing together.